punk and the schooner. No one is punk.
Show number 27 of Noise Punk and Dust Crooner. I am Dust Crooner. Gene, who in God's name are you?
Yo, I'm Noise Punk. Yo, we're show number 27, Noise Punk and Dust Crooner. We got Charles Coleman, got Gene Pritzker. We got some very special guests, but we got two guests.
Yeah.
Two. You get two for the price of one. But how much will you pay? Don't answer yet, because you don't know who they are. So the first guest, we have Evan House.
Composer.
Drummer. What is that? Guitar? No, what is that?
He's making hand gestures.
Hand waver magician.
Yeah.
And his partner in crime,
Gary Height. Here on Noise Punk and Dust Crew.
Gentlemen, I forgot your last name again. Yeah,
nice
welcome to
say hello.
It's Haas.
Hello.
All right.
Oh, what did I say?
House.
That's okay.
You know
sorry.
You're going to get that a lot, unfortunately.
So I'm messing.
Go ahead.
All right.
Every time you see his mouth moving, Charles.
All right, all
your
right.
Your mic is over there. If you can't do this job, you're fired.
Yes, sir.
Please. Charles is going to ask you both a question.
Obvious question. What made you want to pursue this crazy art form of ours? What got everything started?
I mean, for me, music?
Yeah, first music.
I've always done it. I don't know. I was born to it, I guess.
You know, get to the point. He gets to the point. Yeah.
I guess we should ask Gary the same question, but for his art.
Well, his parents are both musicians, I think.
My parents are classical musicians, and while I did a little bit of classical music but I really wasn't into it until my late high school years, and then composing started taking over about the same time. So.
Yeah. And you?
He kind of grew up doing it. But then it was like rock and roll, I think, that lit his fuse in a way, right?
Yes, definitely. There
you go. And what got you started, Gary?
Well,
in the writing world.
Gary's a musician. Gary's a rock musician.
Oh, yeah? What do you play?
And a visual artist and a writer of nonfiction and fiction and poetry.
A Renaissance man.
Very much a Renaissance man.
Right.
Yeah, and I guess I got interested in this sort of thing. Sort of the growing feeling that America was sort of a nightmare, and how do you explore that, and what medium is best for it, and how do you dig into that? You know, how do you unlayer that? And
politics? No,
and I never figured out a way. But one time,
the theater was a work for you.
Yeah, I definitely did a lot of stuff in theater. And I was just fortunate to meet Evan Haas, and he's a great composer, and he had a dream to write some operas.
Right.
This is the dream speech coming up from Evan.
Which is segue to the reason why we have both a composer and our first librettist.
Is that first librettist?
Yes.
Oh, you're our first librettist.
Yay! You made history online here on Noise Punk and Dust Crew. The two of them had written a trilogy of operas, all entitled the Deaf and Esterstah.
I have a really good idea, Charles. Why don't you have Evan talk about his operas?
Why don't you talk about this trilogy?
The Defenestration trilogy.
Defenestration, thank you. First opera being The Birth and Theft of Television, written in 2001. Then The Nightingale, The Last Days of James Forrestal in 2002. And Man, Biology of a Fall, written this past year, 2007. The only other trilogy or group of operas in which all three stories are connected that I can think of, it's not even a trilogy, it's the quartet of operas of The Ring Cycle by Wagner. Did you have that in mind when you pursued this whole thing?
Not really. What happened was really the first story, Gary, was when we really had just first met, and he had a script for a theater script that he was already ready to do. This was in October, and he was going to do it in his annual Love Sphere Festival in the spring solstice of March. And we were at a party, and you know, he asked me if I wanted, to be involved, because he's really inclusive. Everybody's involved in some level. So I said, I don't know. He had a script. So do you want to do some music to this script? And I said, you know, and sort of a very enthusiastic moment, I said, I'll just set the whole damn thing as an opera. How about that?
Watch what you say, I guess.
On that note, we should
What do you have? I mean, what do you if you played somebody before we get in? We're gonna get more detailed, I think, in this opera.
Sure.
But I think as an opening, something that just says, "Bang! This is the opera." You know, I mean.
Yeah.
He's like, ooh.
Should just play the overture. I mean, it's pretty. It's played. I mean, later on, there's some real good stuff. But right, if you want the bang, I would just say, hit the overture.
Right.
And it's so we have to tell you what it is before you hear it. Otherwise, I know it's a lot of talking for a little
right,
music.
Right. So it's okay. We like to talk.
What we see is Edwin H. Armstrong, the inventor of FM. This is the script that Gary had written before I met him, and it has to do with he meets Philo T. Farnsworth, inventor of television, in a bar on the Upper West Side. They're both in patent battles with David Sarnoff. And the opera is basically leading up to Edwin Armstrong committing suicide by jumping off his river house, 13th floor of his river house apartment, which is right down here, about 30 blocks down here. True story. 1954.
Oh, so really, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And Gary's, the context was psyops, right? So that was the theme of his thing. Okay, mm-hmm. So this is merely just an opening. It's a single note where everybody's improvising on it, and that's my depiction of radio static.
Oh, okay.
So the opera's going to come out of radio static, kind of coming at the Siegfried coming out of the E-flat major you know. So then there's just a quick little thing, and then we're right there with Salvatore Basil singing the part of Edwin Armstrong. He's in his apartment about to kill himself, and he's contemplating what made him an inventor in the first place and what brought him to this point. So this is pretty simple musically, but this what's interesting to listen for, though, if we do get to play the end of the most recent opera, I quote the beginning of this opera. So.
Now, is this the beginning of The Birth and Theft of Television?
Yes, Birth and Theft of Television.
Which is the beginning of this cycle of three operas by both our composer Evan Haas and librettist Gary Heit here on Noise Punk and Das Pruner.
Das who?
Kruner.
Did you say Pruner?
Yeah, it's the beer, man.
Do it again.
Das Kruner.
Very nice, Charles. You get a candy.
Have a great respect for some of the men in that book. Tesla was a true prodigy. He understood the electron as few people have before or since. Thousands of miles apart by two separate inventors. Alexander Graham Bell got his patent in a matter of days before the other inventor, whose name no one remembers. If I hadn't invented FM, sooner or later, someone would have. Maybe. And even if you invent something really important, as I did, it still doesn't mean they'll refrain from sticking it to you. What the investment bankers say about inventors? They say, buy the invention, then shoot the inventor.
The prologue to the opera The Birth and Theft of Television, the first in a trilogy of operas entitled The Defenestration Trilogy, by our guests, composer Evan Haas and librettist Gary Hyde, here on Noise Punk and Dust Crooner. Yes, I can't
I should
even
mention
say
that everybody here is drinking whiskey and beer, except for the guy who's messing up all the words. That would be Dust Crooner.
Yeah, for the record.
So that was
very telling.
So that was very hot. I mean, it was a very kind of like what's going to happen next type of introduction, instead of like blah blah blah, you know, more of a this kind
I
of.
I thought of it as expansive, and there's a lot of reasons for that. There was the immediate reason of we're setting off on an opera. I didn't know how long it was going to be when I started writing those notes. I didn't quite know at that time how many pages equaled how many minutes and stuff. I didn't know where it was headed. It's also me embarking on an operatic journey. Yeah. That started off really simple, you know, like Siegfried or something, sure. where you come out of something simple, and it fit what he was doing and the action. So.
You're comparing yourself to Wagner, like, do you hate Jews?
No, I don't.
Charles does.
Yeah, you wish I did. You wish I did, because I kick your ass.
No.
Anyway.
So what sparked for you, Gary, to write this story? I mean, is it just like something you came up with, like
in conjunction always, when you got the
always, no, I think you wrote the
you
first.
Started
yeah,
so this, before this, you. The action does not exist without Gary. I didn't know these people at all.
Right.
I didn't know these stories at all.
Right.
What Gene is trying to wonder: did this story pre-exist prior to the opera? Or
no,
was
we know that. I'm not trying to. Ask
you know, hey. Right now there's the Farnsworth invention, which this Aaron Sorkin play that's doing very well.
Okay. No, okay.
I just want to point out, because I'll also point out later how Nightingale was a year before the Da Vinci Code came out and was everything in that book.
All right.
But we beat we beat the Farnsworth Invention by 6-7 years.
Shouldn't have been beginning sued somewhere.
Okay, go back to
sorry. Yeah, I mean, was this something you were living with? You like these? You knew about these people and wanted always to write a story on? Or
yeah, right? Actually, I had worked at the Museum of Sound Recording for a while, and I got really interested in sound technology, and found out about the history of Edwin Armstrong. And of course, I'd been station manager and a DJ at WKCR FM.
Oh, really? Oh, great.
Which claimed its ancestry from Armstrong as well. Of course, his first FM station was actually in Alpine, New Jersey. Armstrong and Farnsworth both had a bad time, getting their brilliant inventions out to the public. A terrible time. And Armstrong ended up apparently committing suicide. I do sort of raise a question in the libretto if it was really suicide.
Oh, you mean the CIA?
And defenestration is always is a great way to kill people, and there's no way to prove it's homicide.
It's the only way I kill people these days.
Drowning also.
I don't know.
That tells me
if I ever killed Charles, I'm coming to you to get all the facts. Guys.
Yeah, we need
how to do it proper.
We can use the press, you know. Why not?
Okay, should we go to talking about killing? Let's go somewhere where somebody gets killed. Okay.
When someone dies,
I don't want to. You guys tell me where to
There's
go.
There's nothing like opera with death.
You know, I actually think we should go in this opera to a striking moment that is actually a digression from the action. It's called the tube aria.
Tube aria.
The tube aria. It's the tube of a television singing. Mm-hmm. And it's a great performance, and I like the song a lot. And it's the fourth scene out of five. There's prologue, five scenes, epilogue. So it's fourth scene before the longest scene of the opera, which is the fifth scene. And then there's an epilogue where he kills himself. But the tube aria, Gary should say a little bit about what he's trying to say, but the tube is singing. She's got a little chorus, and it's just an immaculate job sung by Shelley Watson. And also danced, and it was a spectacle. And so that we'll hear that. But the tube aria itself is the tube telling that I've, mankind is having these petty wars, but this technology was here, 80 million years ago, and it'll be 80 million years since. These are people just fighting over it now, whatever, something to that effect, right?
Yeah, sort of a melodramatic adaptation of selenium gaining consciousness.
Right. Meaning it's been around. We just try to. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Cool. All right, so that's it. And do you want to mention some of the players?
Please.
You could do it later after the end of the song. I'll do that later.
Well, the musician, it's a small wind group, piano, percussion, and all winds, French horn, trombone, clarinets, flute, oboe, etc. Let me just read all the credit.
Yeah, we'll read the credits later.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
Like they do on a normal TV show where they show the credits after the performance is done.
Go ahead. Gordon Beeferman on piano, Chris Nappy on percussion, Vincent Chancy on French horn, Stuart Bogie on clarinet, Maureen Hurd, my wife, on bass clarinet, I think. Anastasia Micklethwaite on flute, Michael Herbst, one of the founders of Anibalis, on oboe. Stuart Bogie, a current member of Anibalis. So that's so I thought I was pulling in improvising musicians here, although I threw them some bitchin' riffs and hard written out music. They're always those on a pitch. No, there's actually the first scene is a spoken scene with improvise. I'm doing my own sort of
conducting and
sound painting type of thing.
Right.
That's it.
With the hand gestures that we talked about earlier that you were making. So
before I knew what sound painting trademark is, which is Walter Thompson's.
Well, I worked with Walter, man.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I did too. Long after this, but yeah.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah, because I had to learn this whole language of, it was kind of hip, man. But it was a little too complicated, I think.
It's intriguing.
Yeah.
You know who Walter Thompson?
Yeah, of course I do, yeah.
Where do you know him from?
He played with Absolute.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, I got him in there.
You got him there.
I think Kostadi introduced him.
Yes, that's it.
He just hung out with Ornette Coleman, Charles.
I did yesterday.
Arnold Coleman.
Ornette Coleman.
Oh, I was going to say, is that your grandfather?
Yes, my grandfather.
He's just hanging out with his grandfather,
Ornette. We were joking with friends on whether Ornette was my dad, as a matter of fact. But anyway.
Sorry, we digress, as usual. Because
this is the tube aria.
The tube aria.
This begins like all the scenes on a improvised pitch, static. Which we get real static in the sound design in the last scene, but we might not hear that. Anyway, go ahead. Tube aria
from the opera The Birth and Theft of Television, the first of this trilogy of the Defenestration trilogy. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay, just checking. Here on Noise, Punk, and Dust Crooner.
And I see to you. I see what they want me to tell you. I am the ivy they use to bend you away from the earth and to my birth. I am the graven image for excellence, a blank screen for dark caves, a screen on which
The Tube Aria from the opera The Birth and Theft of Television, written in 2001 by both composer Evan Haas and librettist Gary Height. Here are two guests here on Noise Punk and Dust Crooner.
Show number 27. So that was The Tube singing.
The Tube Aria.
The Tube.
Yeah, that's right. She was singing. I got it.
You got a problem with it?
Yeah.
Fucking ass.
Anyway.
Sorry.
We'll be here all night.
We'll be here all night. Tip your waitress. Yeah. So we're just moving on into the world of this opera there's a lot of it. We have a double CD here.
It's five of them.
It's a big box. Five CDs.
It's a box set.
It's a box set. And you can purchase it on. You probably can't purchase it, but Evan, do you have a website? And Gary,
you can't purchase it. Haussmusic.com. Hausse. music.com, and also to see video of the operas, but not this one, which the video mysteriously disappeared from the videoists.
Oh, really?
But we don't have video for it. But other operas at YouTube/GPT Hoss, Hoss, like how it's pronounced, .com. That's my channel, Greenpoint Hoss.
All right.
Okay. And anyway, you can find me on MySpace, too, and hear some music. But Hoss Music... anyway, you can't buy this box set yet.
Now, I'm not saying I'm joking about the buying, but I'm just saying definitely...
Even though you should, out there.
You should appreciate this radio show. Also, this is the first time me and Gary have ever been able to talk to anyone at just sit down and focus on it. And I think this is a very special evening thing.
Cool.
All right.
As we said, a very special show, number 27.
Well, we always say that every show.
What are you going to tell the people?
It wouldn't be funny if I didn't,
son of a bitch. All right, so let's go on with this.
Well, you want to go on to the Nightingale, second...
Oh, no. Well, I think they want to read something.
Please, I'm sorry.
Lyrics.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Did you guys want to read something?
Read.
So I heard something about stage directions and something fun.
Yeah. All right, real quick. He actually wrote stage directions here because, again, it was a play that he had dreamed up, and we did whatever. So he's going to read the words. I'm going to read what the stage... actually, it's more of a video art direction on the side. We could just do like eight lines or something.
Why don't you hold on this mic, and you can hold on to this mic.
This is something that she just sang.
Which side do I read?
You read...
I read that side. Okay, I am the electrical eye.
Diagram of TV.
The first eye in the kingdom.
Mineral kingdom, selenium.
It started with the star imploding.
Star collapse where all heavy elements are alchemized.
My atom smashed to overloading.
Fusion to heavy elements.
Then the star exploded.
Supernova.
The world was not the same.
Solids exist now.
My pieces were named in fire.
Atomic weight.
From that fire stretched a wire.
The first metals.
A river for the electrical sea.
Conductivity.
That is everything that made me.
Electronics.
Then came earth, fire, then men.
Evolution of plant and animal kingdoms.
For all those years that rocks were blind.
Mineral kingdom senseless.
But never silent, the violent pounded rocks to make steel.
Earth kings spawned from early weapons technology, smelting.
So that they could steal wide lands.
Conquest.
With subtle minds, they understood.
Science.
The laws of matter as they splatter
military technology.
Their metal into bodies piling.
Swords, bullets,
high
artillery.
Into the sky.
Aircraft bombing,
to die in planes and making electrical brains.
Computers.
Yay! Well, that was something.
Yeah, your playing wasn't intrusive at all, Gene. But anyway.
But I was trying to find a good sound. Sorry.
Yeah, all right. Whatever.
Okay.
That would have almost been a theremin moment if you had one.
I was looking for like a spatial thing.
Really? Yeah.
I don't know. All right, it's fine. Sorry. Yeah. I'll edit that out. Okay, what are we listening to?
Well, you
next?
Want to go on to the second opera?
Sure. So how do we get to a trilogy? Well, we had no sooner been working on this than Gary said, I want to write about James Forrestal, another person I knew nothing about. And then I look forward to seeing the results, and... you know, it's just, he took it to another level. It's bigger. That Birth and Theft of Television was one act, lasted about an hour. This script was double that. This is a two-actor, and anyway.
Why did you want to do James Forrestal?
It was another defenestration, for one thing, and that's what, but why else?
Yeah, why?
Oh, yeah, James Forrestal was the first Secretary of Defense. He was also the person who put together the National Security Act of 1947, which organized the NSA and the CIA and the Pentagon and all these things that we know about now. You know, the whole national security state, the system of classifying secrets that we're so familiar with. So he put all this together, and yet apparently he committed suicide by throwing himself out of the 16th floor of Bethesda Naval Hospital over depression. A very accomplished man. The whole depression hypothesis seemed sort of forced, and he was at the center of so many of the dark corners of American history in the 20th century that it seemed like this would be a good way to get to poking up some interesting stuff, would be to dig into why those moments before he died. And there was a lot of interesting stuff in the moments before he died. In fact, I mean, who can tell how much of this is fact and how much is fiction? Because there was certainly a lot of spin going on around the death. But one of the things he said was the last thing that he wrote was from Sophocles' Ajax, a very plaintive chorus from that play, which ends in which Ajax is contemplating suicide, mm-hmm. Which ends
successfully.
Which ends in the word nightingale. Uh-huh. And it was suggested by one author that I read this may have connection to Operation Nightingale, which was where they airlifted troops into the Ukraine to overthrow the government that had been put in there, you know, Soviet-led after World War II. Mm-hmm. And maybe he had some regrets about that sort of intrusive operation. But we dug into it. And found there was all sorts of nests of connections and created this opera that's probably more suggests avenues for things to think about that episode in history rather than answers any questions.
For all of you listening out there, there will be a test later. a history test. And please write all this down.
Right.
I mean, this is interesting stuff.
I would like to, but really stop it short, play a bit of the prologue and okay. play a bit of scene one to warm you up to this opera. The prologue is text from a meeting where they gave him an award after they basically fired him or basically asked him to resign. Mm-hmm. They gave him an award and sent him to, he went to Florida for 3 days to relax and then straight to the sanitarium. Hospital. Yeah.
Before I got to Florida.
Anyway, so the prologue is that ceremony. But what I wanted to point out in this prologue is that, some composer stuff, which is that I approached this opera like I had this pipe dream that I would like make it also a statement about the song. And so what I thought I'd begin in the Renaissance. This is kind of a Renaissance type of aria or earlier medieval, really, is what I was interested in, and sort of come up and bring it up through the da capo aria on into, you know, the late Romantic aria or whatever to the pop song, etc. Anyway, I only got so far with that idea before I abandoned it and just wrote the opera, but right. This is very much in that vein. There's nothing but a harp accompanying in a Renaissance style. The text is set from the Congressional Record, so there's no art in it whatsoever.
Right.
I tried to carve out some sort of syllabic structure. Anyway, Mixolydian mode, just blah, blah, blah. But the beautiful coincidence is that I really wanted it being played. I met these guys who play the Ukrainian bandura, Julian Kytasty and Michael Andrek. They had a trio in the East Village. And because of the Ukrainian connection that Gary just mentioned, I'm glad he did. And I thought it'd be great to do it on that. And then I threw out the idea I'd never show up just to play this thing every one time a night, and that's it. You know, I'd do it on piano. Mm-hmm. But I'll be damned if Michael Andrek didn't only play it, but he said, it just so happens that I have a chromatic bandura that can get some of the modulations that you're doing. And he rearranged it. That's cool. It's this beautiful intro.
Great.
Anyway, so this is just the prologue.
Right.
In CD2.
All right.
Okay.
We'll announce it. We'll put it in.
We'll put it. Very simple.
I didn't get all the last days of James Forrestal. And then we're just going to play just like maybe two and a half, 3 minutes of it. Just a little bit to get the flavor.
It's strophic. Charles, don't fuck it up.
Again, the prologue from The Nightingale, The Last Days of James Forrestal. Yeah, I said it right, and I corrected myself anyway.
There's no article. It's just Nightingale, not The Nightingale.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, okay.
He fucked it up.
I like Stravinsky. What can I say?
Nightingale,
The Last Days of James Forrestal, the second opera from this trilogy of operas by Evan Haas and Gary Hite, entitled The Defenestration Trilogy, here on Noise Punk and Dust Crooner.
Mr. Secretary Forrestal, this is not an ordinary committee meeting of the kind you know so well. This is a special meeting. It is called for a specific purpose, to take official note of your retirement yesterday. Mr. Secretary, you have had a long and brilliant career. Much of it has been on the highest level of finance and industry. But it is in the service of your country, as a high official of our government, that you have most singularly distinguished yourself among your fellow citizens. I recall that on August 20, 1940, you assumed the office of the Undersecretary of the Navy. At that time, we had 1,058 vessels, comprising more than 1,892,000 tons, of which 383 were combat vessels. On May 19th, 1944, when we were saddened by Secretary Knox's untimely death, you became Secretary of the Navy, which had grown to more than 40,000 vessels of all types, aggregating more than 10 million tons, of which 1,500 were combat vessels.
And it was your responsibility to direct the expenditure of much of the $118 billion appropriated for the Navy since July 1940.
The prologue from Nightingale, The Last Days of James Forrestal, the second opera from the trilogy of operas entitled The Defenestration Trilogy. I beg your pardon. Composed by Evan Haas and librettist Gary Hyde here
you
on Noise Bucket Dusk.
Every I goddamn tend to do it. Time.
Well, I
put that
well,
in your
you
head.
Don't give me the memo in advance, man.
I'll give you a memo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was very hip. That was very Renaissance, and the words were very just like straight out, you know, nothing's happening.
Yeah, with a certain slight ambiguity of harmony.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Just
exactly.
To give the time of when you're actually composing it.
There's a riff. There's a na 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 da 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 bum bum bum. You know, very no, not even that.
Right on Monteverdi. Yeah, yeah.
And it comes back. You know, right. In the last scene when Truman and him are going at it with each other, and he says, "And you," he like, but fortissimo tutti. You know, it's right. Just he's going ba na ba na ba. You know,
right,
so
right.
It's.
Cool. It's good stuff.
Stuff, man.
All right, but I want to jump right to give you a flavor of what is. That was Martin Moray, by the way, singing Chairman Vinson of the Congressional Armed Service Committee. The next scene we're going to jump to, Forrestal is being dragged into right after this. Basically, during the prologue, he's straitjacketed and taken right to the, you know, skips right to being dragged into the hospital. And I think we'll listen to a bit of it, a long bit of this. I don't know what to do. How much to sit.
That's
but
cool, man. That's
he's dragged cool. in. He's getting used to his surroundings, and then Nightingale comes in. Nightingale is a mistress of his who says, "You have to call me Nightingale," as I sneak into the hospital, supposedly dressed as a nurse, which our director didn't dress her as a nurse, but that's what she's supposed to have done.
Right. Oh, yeah.
And,
what was he dressed
as? His mistress was like the sort of honorary fundraising chairwoman of the Red Cross. So we thought it would be charming for her to make her assignations with him, which apparently she made in the disguise of a nurse.
I see.
And then call herself Florence Nightingale, you know, get the Nightingale thing going.
Right. She chaired the Red Cross, Pauline Davis, of the Morton Salt dynasty.
So again, this is all like real people from real life.
Real. Everything's real people. And it's like the way the librettos are written, right, which I guess is what we should be talking about here tonight, is like Gary takes the points of that we know by reading, you know, maybe the main source on that, and says, "Well, we know that he was dragged in on this date, and we know that somebody Truman visited him, you know, one day, bringing bourbon. That's all you know, and we know that, you know, LBJ visited him against his wishes, you know, and just little bits, and then that's all we know. And
then you put him in dresses.
Yeah, we put him in dresses.
That's Edgar Hoover, not LBJ.
Yeah, whatever, who cares."
You're an idiot.
They're all the same.
Here Forrestal is being dragged in saying, "I don't expect to leave this place alive." And that's an actual quote that he said when he was being taken into the hospital. "I don't expect to leave this place alive." And so they're also, the brilliant things about the libretto are that these is peppered with real quotes. Mm-hmm. So you all, as a composer, you have to love that because you're clinging, you know, it's like a swinging bridge, a rope bridge. What do you call those things? Suspension bridges, where it's like, you know, you have these points, and then you're basically dangling in the middle of these points, and it's able to do anything you want to do. So,
So which scene is this?
This is scene one, right after the prologue. He's being dragged into the hospital, and it's going to go to Pauline Visit. She comes and she sings "Ode to a Nightingale" by John Keats as he's under sedation. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is this opera and the one after is that the main character is under sedation a lot of the time because. So he's saying, you know, he talks about that. He's reading a book of poetry and he dozes off, and then she comes in, picks up his song, and says, "Sing some Keats." And then whatever they talk to each other for long. We're just going to go because this is also for as far as the song thing goes. Mm-hmm. This is the aria when she begins singing from Keats' "Ode to a Nightingale." That's the first thing I wrote in the opera, and I was like, "This is the kind of da capo aria."
Right, the big aria. Okay, so the big
scene
aria.
One from Nightingale: The Last Days of James Forrestal, the second opera of this trilogy by Evan Haas and stop hitting me, Gene.
I'm just trying to mess you up.
And Gary Hyde here on Noise Punk and Dust Cooner.
Oh, you kind of got that right.
That's right.
That's not good.
I don't expect to leave this place alive.
You're delirious.
Where are the balls?
Now just relax and readjust to your condition.
A dark performance.
Call me a medic.
Delirium.
Here you are.
A diagnosis. Take care with that arm as you unhitch it. Why am I so high? The pity.
Well, I don't know. But I'm sure you'll be safe here. We'll be watching you constantly.
Do you realize how unappealing the prospect is to me?
I know we'll all do our utmost to be respectful, Mr. Forrestal, sir. We're all proud to have this duty, sir. First Secretary of Defense. Imagine it. I am just a poor kid from Kansas, and you're a millionaire, the most powerful man on earth. Set the president, I guess.
What an autograph.
Give me a pen.
Give me a pen.
You're going to have to earn that pen, Mr. Forrestal.
And to think I committed my wife.
It ain't so bad, Mr. Forrestal. Think of it as a vacation. They'll keep you so high in here you'll have to relax. Take these. Otherwise, it might be hard to fall asleep. Your first night here would be for me.
The manacles are chemical.
Well, that's all right. Some folks don't like pills. Works faster anyway, sir.
Digest, Gone with the Wind, Hemingway, an anthology of world poetry. Thank you.
and sleep right. What is going on?
It's me.
Polly.
Don't say my name. You must call me Nightingale. What's wrong? You're suddenly white as a sheet.
Nightingale, if only you knew that a word so sweet could conceal bloody horrors deep. My secret shame is for my love a secret name.
Who's there?
Ensign Price, step down. Can't you see I'm with a lady?
But it's... she's not authorized.
If you won't leave me alone for just 1 hour, God will make a special hell for you.
I understand, Mr. Forrestal, but I won't be far.
Nightingale, forgive me my presumption.
I couldn't stay away. I had to see you, Jim. You fell so far, so fast. I had still hoped to marry you once
again. Now there's no way for Nightingale. I love you freely without the dignity of everyday intimacy, which was a shrine from one's idols to another was, like me, Secretary of the Navy, or Roosevelt. I thought you wanted me for the office.
No, I did that with Dwight Davis, and the poor man died.
Well, I really only stuck around to get Secretary of State.
From Nightingale, The Last Days of James Forrestal, the second opera from a trilogy of operas entitled The Defenestration trilogy, composed by composer Evan Haas and librettist Gary Height, here on Noise Punk and Dust Crooner. Yeah, whatever. Yes.
Yeah, man, no, the last section, especially with those chords, man, I was really feeling that. And yeah. We were talking about how, Evan was saying during we were listening to it, how he, some of this music, he went back to it to edit or whatever you were doing with it, and how you really thought that you really felt it, right? You really
In the last just couple of weeks, I've been updating the score, you know, in Finale or whatever, and I was just really proud of what I'd written in general and other scenes too. Just carrying. I don't know. Well, I like the notes. You were up close and personal with the notes. And I liked them.
You mentioned that you felt you were in some kind of a zone, a very creative zone, which all of us feel at some point often. I mean, with me, when in order to get to that zone, I have to be uninspired, get frustrated, yell at my score asking, what the hell do you want from me? Then I go to bed, and then I know what I want to write, and that's how I get into the zone. You have to go through that whole process. At least that's with me. Does you relate to that at all?
Do you usually talk to paper, Charles?
Yes, I do.
Yes. You were talking to paper just that. I have to say that the way it happened with these was that it was sort of a workman like thing where I was writing. I had, you know, it was like when you say you're going to do an opera in April and it's February and it's half written, you're writing every day. And, exactly. And so I was living alone at the time. You know, my wife hadn't joined me, and we have a family now. It's a little different, but at the time, I would write. Just write, and it was great. I mean, I'd write stuff that I thought was crap, and then I'd come to a point where I couldn't write anymore, and then I always, my medicine for that was always, I lived near this little park in Greenpoint, was always two times around the park.
Oh, really?
Once is just getting it, you know, two worked better than one, and I would write, walk around twice, I'd come back, and it was amazing. Suddenly,
I walk my dog every morning and get that. Like, I think about before what I'm supposed to write when I come home. Come back in the morning. When I come back, in like 3 hours straight every day.
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah.
And so the zone just came, you know, in all those periods, all those days, every now and then there'd be a day that was just really good. You know, so the zone was more worked at, and like a teacher named David Baker I worked with used to tell me, he said, you know, I'm there every morning composing from 7 to 10, and the muse knows where I am. She doesn't show up every day, but I'm there waiting for her. You know, I'm not that regular, but that was a great quote.
I 100% agree to that, because that's, you know, I get up in the morning and I write music. That's my work, and what's the word?
Discipline.
Discipline. Yeah, it's pure discipline. And the thing is, I mean, I don't believe in inspiration. I believe that you're supposed to be inspired all the time. I mean, I know people disagree. I know Charles disagrees with me.
I disagree with you. I think there's a lot of truth to that, but it's good to have a discipline to at least be there in case something comes up.
I don't write anything until it's all basically finished in my head anyway, from beginning to end. So when I come in the morning to write, it's basically...
I don't do that. I respect that. I'm like writing, I don't know what's going to happen, right. And I at the end of the day, I look back and say that was a good day or that was bad, and I might...
But you go in your head, before you sit down to write... You go through the music in your head, right?
Vague sense, right?
Well, I'm not talking about, you know.
Depends on the pieces. Some pieces I know what you're talking about, but just to bring it back to the operas, with these operas, it was definitely also my first experience setting so many words. It was definitely just finding, you know, called Durchführung.
Gestalt. I'm not really talking, because for me, the least important things in music is the rhythm notes. I mean, I'm not talking
The
notes and rhythms, those, I go, you know, get up in the morning, look for, but that's easy. Anybody
there's two approaches. There's the you know, draw a gesture as a little squiggle, and then fill in this very elaborate sort of orchestration to it later, where everybody gets their information that they need to play. But there's also sort of the art of fugue approach, where it's like I have four voices and I have to only move forward on a good note.
Right, but that doesn't require inspiration. That just requires actually skill, you know, so you could really do that at any time. But the essence of the piece is what it requires inspiration, which I kind of feel like I live with all the time. And once I get an essence of my piece, I could finish the piece from beginning to end without knowing one note I'm going to write. Or one fugue I'm going to work out.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm kind of saying. When I say beginning to end, I don't know one note. I don't know one melody.
No, yeah.
But picking out notes and melodies is kind of, that's like technique, which we have. Mm-hmm. And we don't have to, you know, some people, that's the hardest thing for them because they don't know anything. So they go to the piano, they see major chord and they don't know where to go next or whatever. This is, right. We're on the next level. So when I say finish a piece, like, you know the essence of the piece, you know what you're going to write. Now it's time to do work.
Shut up, Gene.
Anyway. I'm totally following. Yeah.
Yeah. Evan knows what I'm talking about. At least somebody knows what I'm talking about.
It's really frustrating,
Gene. Fucking doing the show with Charles, who doesn't know what you're talking
Gene,
about.
Gene, I want you.
Talks to paper. Sorry. I'm going to get into a physical fight.
CD cases.
Well, I'm sorry. Gary, what are you. I mean, it's definitely, obviously, it's different for maybe writing, but not really. I think it's similar, maybe, in writing
words.
Well,
in the case of all three of these, the writing was driven by research. Mm-hmm. And so what I would do is I'd find out about this fascinating story, and then I would investigate,
right.
Find out all the information I could possibly find, and then try to figure out, well, how is this interesting?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's dramatic about
it? You're trying to find the essence of it all.
And you hear it that at the beginning, we have that long recitation from the Congressional Record telling James Forrestal's buildup of the Navy. You know, he'd built 2 billion tanks, 4 zillion airplanes, and stuff like that. And, you know, the thing is that then contrasts with the insanity that later goes on. You know what I mean?
Right,
it also
right.
shows, like, the hypocrisy of these people who are praising him only to open the booby hatch right under their feet 2 seconds later, you know?
Right.
On that happy note...
There was no happy note. That was sad stuff.
What would you like to go to next?
Okay. What I'd really like to do, and you know, this is the expansive version. What I'd really like to do is play Act One, Scene Four, beginning, middle, and end, which is we're talking 10 minutes
of the same opera.
Let's do it. And what this is going to be in three tracks, Gene. Just so you know.
Shit.
Yeah.
Aww.
This was the beauty of, Gary's experience in the theater is that each scene is very simply set. I mean, you're basically just in a chair on stage. I mean, right. he knows the practical aspects of what's needed. So a lot of the scenes of this opera, almost really all of them are just him in his room.
Right.
With visitors. So in this case, here is one of his couple sessions with the psychiatrist he had to talk to. And, This is sort of a rant of Gary's, really. He starts off saying, our age is the culmination of the Renaissance. Missile, shell, germ, bomb, all the weapons we've decided to research, we now have working perfectly, you know, and things like that. And so he's telling the psychiatrist all this. And then he has a moment where he talks about, your clearance isn't high enough for me to tell you all the things I want to tell you.
Right.
And there's this funny moment there. And then he has a jolt, and he says, starts talking about what he saw at Iwo Jima and things like that. And then he has, and this is also a credit to Salvatore Basil, who sang, Forrestal as well as Armstrong. This scene should and bronze him. Because of he's got arias speaking back to an aria, back to a huge energetic aria, to a long spoken dialogue, and he's a great actor too, and then back to another aria that just builds. And the latter third of this is on my YouTube site. You should see him do it. But so he sings about that. He has a long spoken thing about why he's not religious, and then he sings about having seen the A-bomb test at the Bikini Atoll, mm-hmm. and sings about that experience, and then it ends. And then the most caustic yet Gary Hydean ending is that after it ends, the whole scene, this is the ending of the first act, the psychiatrist says, I think it's a good place to stop today.
The concluding scene of Act One of Nightingale, the last...
Yes. David Gordon, who's singing the third opera, is also singing the part of the psychiatrist here.
On the Nightingale, The Last Days of James Forrestal, composed by Evan Haas and librettist Gary Hite, from the trilogy, the Defenestration Trilogy, here on Noise, Punk, and Das Crooner.
The problem that we're having is that I love to be crazy. Have you read the Bible?
I'm not religious.
Nor am I. Religion collected the Bible, but it came after the word. The book of Revelations, John, exiled to Patmos, writes a letter in code to the churches of Asia Minor. The key is in the scripture somewhere. Our languages are quotes, and their earliest quote book scripture. John's mirror of Daniel, Revelations. The four horsemen, Comet, Jewett, Bush, and Groves.
I'm afraid I'm missing your point.
You don't know the full litany of horrors that have been unleashed in this war.
Tell me then.
Our age is a combination of the Renaissance. Our science no longer abstract and idle but working. It's shell, gun, missile, gas, germ, and bomb. Computing trajectories with differential gears. Machines are being taught to kill indiscriminately. We are all threatened.
We all appreciate your wartime achievements, but the question is, how will you get better?
No, that's not the real question, but I can't tell you what that is. Your clearance isn't high enough.
My clearance has been extended to MJ-12.
There are higher clearances. Much higher. The executive orders multiplied as every new secret came along. The orders are nested deep. That's the highest clearance for the government only, not for the... Can I get a phone up here?
Why, relax, what are you feeling?
These are trying times, George. I can't give up.
You can't give up what?
Being Secretary of Defense, I guess.
The Lord. Amen.
noise was that?
I thought you said you weren't religious.
I was raised a Catholic. Now it's all irony to me. You've heard the phrase, kill them all, God knows his own. It's a Benedictine slogan from Albigensian barbecues. Cathars of the Languedoc region believed that Jesus had taken Magdalene to wife, that he had living descendants. The church wiped them out, man, woman, and child. I'm not religious. My religion, for most of my life, has been money. The unseen hand, the balance sheet in which all are justly weighed. I stopped going to church when I was 17, doctor. No, doctor. I don't know if you can understand what it does to a man to wield mega-death. It's not a sense of sin. Operation Crossroads.
The bomb tests at Bikini Atoll.
It was July 1st, 3 years ago, a lagoon in an atoll was filled with empty ships, useless rusty tubs on the wall. We sat in a languid sea. The tiny B-29 crawl across the sky. Thin light, more than another sun torch. Waves of light, and I swear to God, although I never told another man, I saw the face of death rise up in flame from within that light and laugh at us there on the deck, seemingly out of reach. By God, I knew he was looking at me and laughing in full measure. I saw the fish rising and dying. I saw the hulls cracked like nuts. Steel vaporized. I watched the sailors dive at command into the radioactive waves to test the effects of their bodies. And I saw the glow of the faces of the admirals around me. I became sick at their playing like children with fire and their intoxication with sheer power.
Jim, I think that's a good place for us to stop for today.
The conclusion to Act One of Nightingale, The Last Days of James Forrestal, the second opera in the trilogy of the Defenestration trilogy, composed by Evan Haas and librettist Gary Height here on Noise Punk and Dust Crooner.
Yeah, man. That was some serious Da Vinci Code shit going on in the middle, right? Right? We're just talking about that stuff.
Yeah.
And Evan said, well, you asked the question.
You wanted to ask your librettist something, don't you?
Yeah, well, separate from that, but I just want to say that that he's sort of in on he's already tapped out that conspiracy theory, the grand conspiracy theory of Jesus and Magdalene being married and all that. And this, in this opera, he brings it up a lot because Forrestal is a former, well, he's a Catholic, but an unpracticing sort of Catholic that who is in with the Knights of Malta, and there's all this kind of stuff. And so Gary like runs with that. I don't want to talk for Gary, but I do want to ask Gary this. In all the operas, he quotes. There's always some juicy scripture. That it's almost as if he finds the history, and then in the absence of history, he'll throw some scripture up in there to make it, you know, to make his point. So I want to see why. What's that?
You
went all about?
Under them religious bonds.
Well, you know, the thing is that the Bible is like the source code for our culture,
right?
And you know, it runs through all the texts, and so once you start picking up that those scriptural roots in this stuff, it comes out all over the place. And in this particular opera, I picked up on the historical conflict between the Templars and the Knights of Malta. Mm-hmm. And the legendary thing is that the Templars became the Freemasons. And of course, Truman was a big Freemason, and Forrestal is more aligned with the Catholic side and the Knights of Malta. So, in the absence of facts.
We didn't get to the Truman scene, by the way, but anyway, there's a big Truman scene in the second act.
Yeah, there's and Truman, you know,
Margaret Truman, felt, rest in peace. She died this week. Oh. His only daughter. Anyway,
yeah, and she was a pianist,
singer,
and a singer.
Really? Oh, he was a pianist.
He was a pianist, and she was the singer. Yeah. I remember they used to play music together or something like that.
Right. With Bill Clinton.
So the there's. So that the whole Freemason versus Templar thing gets picked up in this opera to a certain extent, and you know, that's a fight that goes back, you know, 1,000 years or so. I think 1,300, 700 years, 600 years, and one of the themes of all three operas is about the persistence of these of the past. Mm-hmm. And how these things that we think that we've gone through persist, you know, and keep haunting us in a way. Mm-hmm. And in the first opera, it's manifest in the form of a dinosaur, a purple dinosaur who represents the simultaneously European royalty and Barney.
I love you. You love me.
And Barney's evil. I swear to God, every time my kid turns on Barney, man, I slap him. No, I'm joking. I don't slap my kids. Yeah. Call social services.
And then in the second one, we talk about the Freemasons and the Templars. And the third one,
you mentioned there's a great quote in one of the songs, Jeremiah. No, that was in this one. Hosea 13, death, I will be thy plagues. And it's about biological warfare.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in the third one, they're actually releasing plagues. And they release a sort of pre-human worm-like, you know, ancestral being that consumes humanity itself.
In all of his operas, there's something greater devouring humanity.
Yes.
Well, it's not an opera until a lot of people die.
The third opera entitled Man, Biologically... let's try that again.
What are you even saying? Do you know what you're playing?
What?
Do you know which track you're playing?
I'm getting to that.
You know?
Man, Biology of a Fall, written in 2007. I just wanted to get that over with.
Oh, okay. I thought you were announcing a
track. No, I wasn't going to. What were we going to hear? This is where I asked...
That's a track.
What would you like to hear? In the interest of just throwing down some music before I talk about the opera, let's just throw down the Monkey Song, where this is Frank Olson, who's an army bacteriologist with his friend Benjamin Wilson working in the lab and Fort Detrick in Maryland, the home, still the nexus of biological weapons research, although Nixon outlawed offensive biological weapons in 1969. So now it's purely defensive biological weapons we're researching.
What about childless breath? What would that be called?
And, but so they're just singing. This is a sort of a bawdy song of them singing. It's like a waltz or something where they're singing, there's high risk killing monkeys for freedom. The same thing. And, they're killing monkeys for freedom, and that's what the song's about. And what was I going to say? No, I don't. I'll tell more about the opera later, but they're in the lab.
Right.
Killing Monkeys.
Monkey Song from third opera of this trilogy entitled Man, Biology of a Fall, composed by composer Evan Haas and librettist Gary Height here on Noise Punk and Das Kruder. Nicely done indeed. The Monkey Song from the third opera of the trilogy, Man, Biology of a Fall, composed by composer Evan Haas and librettist Gary Height, our guests here on Noise Punk and Das Kruder.
You're getting good at that. You're going to get a job somewhere.
Yeah, really?
Blow
wow.
You're going to give a job somewhere. All right, what's next? Let's go on to...
Okay, so this opera is about Frank Olson, who was a worked for the Army in biological weapons research, and it's a complicated story where he was also involved. There was a marriage sort of between the a division of the CIA and the division of the Army, where the Army was working on biological weapons and the CIA was interested in things like LSD and drugs for mind control research, truth serums, and things like that. So they were just experimenting on monkeys, and we're going to jump forward. This whole scene, we're going to go right to Act Two, and we're going to do the later parts of this opera. This is a scene. It documents his last week in New York City, where he was brought up from D.C. He lived in Frederick, Maryland, but he was brought up from Maryland and to have psychiatric treatment in New York City with. Because he had just been given LSD against his knowledge as an experiment, and he was not happy about that. He was—I won't say he's freaking out. He wasn't that bad off, but he just was concerned. So they brought him up here for a week. He had all these strange visits, and so again, it's a suspension bridge idea where we're drawing points of fact, and then there's a lot of freedom in between those points of fact. The second act is basically his eight scenes and all his visits touching all these bases in New York that week that we know very little about. And in one case, he disappeared from his hotel room. The person that was watching him woke up and he was gone. And all they know is he came back. He was showed up at the lobby of this is the Hotel Statler, which is now the Pennsylvania Hotel across from Penn Station. And he showed up in the lobby, crashed out on the couch, and with his wallet missing, and just sort of he'd been out all night walking the streets, and they were very concerned because they didn't want him to run away. But anyway, this is a great scene where we say where he was that night. no one knows where he was.
Which scene is this?
This is Act 2, Scene 7. So he's in a Greenwich Village bar, and this fictional character named Billy, who's an African-American poet and like bohemian of the village, you know, starts bending his ear at the bar. You know, he's in there, and he's saying he's it's a complete spectrum apart. It's all it's all rhythmic speech, notated rhythms. Mm. So the reason I'm playing this is because not only is a great actor in Christopher Burris who sings Billy, but it's a great contrast. It's an operatic experiment on my part, where it's a spoken person speaking to an opera singer.
Right. So one singing, one speaking.
One singing, one speaking. There's a bartender who's sort of doing speaking, and the music is sort of like third string jazz. Sort of like we put a trio in the middle of the stage of bass, trombone, bass, and bass clarinet, and each of those instruments represents one of the three people in the scene, and the orchestra's on the side. So it's sort of just interesting musically. Yeah. And
let's hear this motherfucker,
Gunther Schuller or something like that, you know.
Very Gunther Schuller. That's something you don't hear every day.
You don't hear that every day.
What's your band like? Very Gunther Schuller.
And Stephen Ebel sings the part of Frank Olson, which we'll hear more of, but in this scene he doesn't have a lot to sing. But I think that Gary was thinking about Daniel Carter for Billy. Imagine Daniel Carter, because I've heard Daniel Carter, the improvising trumpet player in New York, the scene today. Am I wrong?
Well,
I've heard him speak and rant and stuff.
I think Daniel was something of an inspiration for this person, but I didn't realize it until you just said it right now. There's
history made on Noise Punk and Dust Crooner.
There's actually another two or three other people that I think of in connection with his character, but when I think about the actual words that come out of his mouth, I think this is Daniel's anti. Establishment, anti-authority, anti-everything rant. Right. Anyway.
There you go. Cool.
And it supposedly takes place, by the way, in November, Thanksgiving night itself, maybe, of 1953.
But only my fault. Any of these words are mine and not to be blamed on Daniel Carter.
There you go.
Charles?
Scene 7 from the opera Man.
Yes.
Act 2, Scene 7.
Act 2, Scene 7.
Dope! Man, Biology of a Fall, composed by composer Evan Haas and librettist Gary Hite here on Noise Punk and Dust Crooner.
Do it!
And that's magic, baby. And how's about a free one, Al?
Here you go. Chin.
Hey,
that'll be $1.50.
You know what that is?
What? Money?
Yeah. What is it?
You need some money.
Just because I'm a black man. You think I'm asking for money?
No, I just...
Let me tell you what money is.
Okay.
Money is magic. Look here, the pyramid, the eye. Novo Ordo Seclor Unum. That means New World Order. That was a phrase Hitler used, the 13 stars. That's not for the states. Black magic. They got us running around like fools for these dollars. They ain't backed by gold. They ain't backed by silver. They're backed by that guy at the bar. They're backed by me.
breaking my back!
Your back don't look broke.
Hey, I can tell you some smoke. But anyway, this dollar here, you see, this dollar was earned by me. What do I get? The scraps of the sea. A tinful kit of time to bet. Apparently 5 hours are barely enough to get me a meal. Get everybody dancing on the tip of your string. That's magic to me. The look here, the numbers are different. That's the mystique. Each can be traced. Its whereabouts placed.
I was just told that magic is the art of deception.
Manipulate perceptions. Interpolate projections. Obfuscate connections. Penetrate inspections.
You sound like you're reciting Kant.
Just my own lyrical inflections. Listen, if this represents an hour, or whiskey, what happens if I burn it?
One less whiskey for you.
It's something that I have to do. I like to think of that value floating around, unowned.
What do you do for a living?
I just keep giving until it hurts, baby. I'm a poet, artist, what's worse, advertiser.
Act 2, Scene 7 of Man, Biology of a Fall, composed by Evan Haas and librettist Gary Height here on Noise Punk and Dust Crooner, the third in a trilogy of operas entitled The Defenestration Trilogy.
Digging it, man.
Yeah.
Totally hip. A little Sprechstimme.
Jazzy Sprechstimme.
A little jazzy Sprechstimme. Yo, let's go on. What's next? Give me something else. Give me something. Hit me, motherfucker. Hit me.
Oh, okay, yeah. So this actually goes to three acts, or I like to say two and a half acts, because the third act is shorter. We are going to jump to, maybe we should just, man, I want to play that. The thing is like, you got to, shoot,
it's hard,
man.
To make choices.
Well, a lot, the scene, the rock in this scene is just so rocking that the singers get buried. I don't think anyone's going to get the words. We should, and so maybe I should just go right to, I don't know, go right to the ending.
Do
you want me to give it? I'm going to give it away because I don't think this opera will be produced soon enough for me, for the fact that I'm giving it away how it ends.
Oh. So I think give it away.
I'm going to give it away because when's
we know how Labo M ends. The soprano dies. I mean,
the soprano dies in Labo M.
Yeah, and they still see it. So it doesn't matter whether they know the ending.
I never saw the end.
Mimi.
Sorry. Well, this is the last scene of the opera. It's 10 minutes long.
All right.
And, so much has happened in this opera. Let me see if there's a question I can ask Gary about, I don't know. Okay, so Gary, like, you, the grand themes that run through Gary's operas are the persistence of history, and he's also got a thing about money and banks and the fact that we're owned by European British bankers or something. And
well,
I want to,
you know, there are all these people who say there are no conspiracies, and I think that's so silly because most of what goes on is conspiracies. I mean, you don't have people in a business going to tell everybody what they're doing. You know, they do it. And they do it in secret, and then the effects are shown. I mean, that's 99% of what happens in this world. And you look at investment banks, merchant banks, some of the biggest movers creating the railroad landscape, the industrial landscape in the United States, and they're certainly not transparent. They're keeping their records secret, and in fact, they prefer certain states that have stricter laws about bank privacy and so forth. So, you know, I mean, these people are out there. They're doing their thing. They're trying to make some money. That's all it is. You know?
Music.
Yeah, baby.
Music coming by Gene Pritzker and Evan Haas here on Noise Punk and Us Gruner. So
yeah, man, we just told it to the man.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that feeds into Olsen here, but at the end, we're in Olsen's hotel room. This is the night that he's murdered, and he calls his wife. This is seen in two parts, and then the murderer busts in the room, who I really don't have to tell you who it is because we haven't even talked about him in the context of the earlier scenes.
Right,
but
right.
The murderer comes in, and the guy, his watchdog, is a two-bedroom place, room, and there's three people in the room. Murders Olsen, throws him out the window. He lands on the sidewalk out across the street from Penn Station. And the third guy who kind of witnesses the whole thing sings a little aria at the end. George is the name of the murderer, George White, and that's not proven or anything. He's a real person who was involved in this story in a lot of ways, but that's just a fic. You know, that's what we say. It's a, if anything, it's metaphorical. If it's true, maybe it's true. Who knows? But we, you know, as we say before the opera every night, we'd say this is a story where all the names have not been changed, but we don't know what the facts are.
And we should mention the fact that the guy going through the window is the aspect that links all three of these operas, as we mentioned before.
Yeah, after Nightingale, I said, it was really, I think it was my wife, A, came up with the term defenestration trilogy, and B, mentioned that it should be a trilogy, and I said to Gary, it has to be a trilogy, and fortuitously, Gary says, well, I wanted to write about Frank Olsen.
Right.
So it was like, beautiful, perfect.
Cool. Defenestration. I have to spell this word correctly soon, so I'm going to copy it.
Right, so here it is.
Because I won't be able to.
The concluding scene of the opera, Man, Biology of a Fall, composed by Evan Haas and librettist Gary Hyde here on Noise Punk and Us Crooner.
Well said, Charles. Well said.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm high as a kite. I'm here to do this thing right.
Jesus, George, what are you doing?
You're a fucking tough guy, you carry a gun. But I can tell you're a fucking chemist, son. Let me show you what tough is. Let me show you how the hell it's done. What have you been telling Billy? The swizzle stick, huh?
Another thespian.
You killed him! He ain't dead yet.
What am I gonna say?
He jumped
right through the window.
Yeah, right through the window. It's a fucking classic. I'm gonna get the hell out of here.
The conclusion to the opera Man, Biology of a Fall, the third in this trilogy of operas entitled the Defenestration Trilogy. Trilogy. Sorry. I never get it right.
Music, mess up now.
Music by Evan Haas and librettist Gary Height, well, here on Noise Punk.
That was the abridged version. That was the, like, when you have a test and you don't want to hear the whole thing, so you get the little, like,
give him a taste.
What do you call it? The flip notes. The cliff notes.
Flip notes, yeah.
The cliff notes of the opera. So, but if you want to go buy the opera, go to... No, I'm joking. He's not telling
you. Obvious final question. What's up next for both of you? Evan?
Nothing.
Okay.
How existential.
Okay, Gary, what have you got? You got anything coming up?
Well... You know, I work full-time as a literary agent, and I have a play that I'm producing in April at Medicine Show Theater called Robo-Hamlet, which is sort of the opposite of Hamlet Machine by Heiner Müller. It's like sort of a pulp version and in which humans are exterminated by crabs.
Horatio, I know him well.
Charles got crabs, but he's
to
still
be
alive.
Or not to be, that is the question.
Sorry.
You know, Hamlet,
Charles
robot.
Got crabs, but he's still alive.
Anyway.
Charles, why are you ruining my house?
Because I love you, Gene.
Clean. Anyway. Wait, Evan, really, what do you have next?
You must have some
kind of concert or something. What is this?
No, I literally...
Did you just spend all your time in this opera and didn't book anything else? Is that what happened?
I didn't... Exactly right. I didn't book anything. I was not out building bridges for the last year. Let's put it that way.
All right. You're going to have to come out and do... I have some concerts...
Somebody play my music, please.
I have some concerts I'm producing, and I have to get you out of your hole then.
There you go.
Or something. Anyway.
Jais, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for coming. We enjoyed the opera, and I hope you people out there enjoyed it as well.
Yeah. Do you want to, it was said earlier, I know we're closing, do you want to end with a humorous song from the first opera?
Well, I tell you what, how about this, since usually at the end we play our theme song, but instead of the theme song, how about we end
with... you should definitely want your theme song, I love your theme song.
So, yeah, but
everyone knows it, let's make history.
And we've done this before, actually. We'll end with your piece. So what's the name of the piece?
It's called You Mow Row After Row. It's the moment Farnsworth discovers how television is going to be made when he's mowing his field in Idaho. He's this young Mormon 15-year-old kid in Idaho, and he's plowing his field, and he sees how you can put ions in rows and create a television. And that held true. He proved that. So this is the moment. He's in his San Francisco lab with his two assistants prancing around. We just discovered it. And yours truly is actually singing the bass part, because I've never been able to find a bass to sing in any of my operas. And you hear people laughing at a moment, because we're actually dancing on stage with radios. So.
All right.
That's a good end to the show.
And on that happy note, gentlemen, thanks for hanging out with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And that's show number 27 of Noise Punk and Dust Crew. And hey, here comes the music.
You mow row after row.
By Evan Haas.
And until next time.
Gary, and I'll be out of the
noise to you.
This life looks fine 100 times. 150. Turn the second round around. Sawtooth, that's what I need. You could make a real TV if you mow row after row.
to cover everything.
And patented
an industry, we'll see.
A real need to deal with me, like deforestation.